Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, we will take up again a subject we certainly have discussed before many times on this program, and that is the Bush administration and its struggle to meet the challenge of international terrorism. Our guest is Ron Suskind. He's the author of a book that was published a little bit earlier this summer that got a lot of attention. The title is The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Simon & Schuster is the publisher, and the title of the book refers to an incident that will ask him to talk about here, involved Vice President of the United States, in which he articulated a kind of approach to the threat of terrorism that said, even if we think there's just the tiniest chance that terrorists could get their hand on a weapon of mass destruction, we should act on that as if it was a certainty and act accordingly. And that kind of thinking has been widely applied to many other threats and perceived threats against the United States since this happened back in 2001. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. He's the author of a book that, another book that got a lot of attention, sold very well, a book entitled The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill, which centers on the experiences early in the Bush administration of the first Secretary of the Treasury of the Bush administration. He's also author of the book A Hope in the Unseen, an American Odyssey from the Inner City to the Ivy League, and he discussed that with our Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine when that book came out. From 1993 until 2000, he was senior national affairs reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where he won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. We only ask, please, callers to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along. Get in as many different people as possible. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. Mr. Suskind, hello.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. And yourself?
Just dandy.
Good. To start, I suppose the natural place to start is to talk about the title and that event back in the fall of 2001. This was not all that long after 9/11, and it apparently took place at a briefing. Mr. Cheney, the vice president, was being briefed on the possible continuing threat from al-Qaeda. Tell that story.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The book is full of episode and incident moments in the Oval Office, the Situation Room, and some are really defining of U.S. policy. This certainly is one. It's 2 months after 9/11. It's November, and the vice president is being briefed by the CIA. Folks from NSC are there as well, about a report, intelligence, showing that Pakistani nuclear scientists sat with bin Laden and Zawahiri just a few weeks before 9/11 to discuss feasibility issues in and around small nuclear weapons. Of course, this is a harrowing bit of intelligence. And the vice president, as the briefing proceeds, says, essentially, we need to think in a different way about these low-probability, high-impact events. And then by the end of the briefing, he has that different way and says succinctly, if there's a 1% chance that WMDs have landed in the hands of terrorists, we need to treat it as a certainty, not in our analysis or the preponderance of evidence, he demurs, but in our response. And at that moment, everyone in the room sort of recalls it like it was Tuesday. At that moment, you could see the lights of what U.S. policy would be for the years, the 5 years since 9/11. The vice president essentially saying that evidence is too high a bar to expect or demand in this era. We may have to act with the awesome powers of the United States on little more than suspicion because we have no choice. Interestingly, there are folks, even on the left, who are sitting in the room as they read this part. They're quite alarmed by it all, who also say, I'm not sure what choice the vice president has at that point. It's a time of real panic. But ultimately what you see is that this untethers us from the traditional moorings of evidence underlying action, which, of course, are part of Enlightenment principles, of actually the rule of law going back for centuries, millennia even. And we untether ourselves from that with some consequences that clearly are unexpected and grievous. Interestingly, though, I think that what this shows is accountability. That was the choice we made And by virtue of it, clearly there have been some successes, but also we seem to create a new problem or two or three new problems for everyone that we've solved. So
yeah,
there you go.
Well, I think that there are a number of things, I think, about the book that are interesting and important to think about and talk about. And one of them is that it seems that there was, at least from this time, and I don't know if perhaps even before, but from this time, you can see the beginning of a significant kind of rift between the White House and perhaps also we will include the Department of Defense,
right,
and the intelligence community, and of the intelligence community, those people that have the lower profile,
yep,
those people you call the invisibles.
Yeah.
These are not the people that show up on the Sunday morning talk shows. They're not the people that go out and give speeches. Mm-hmm. They're the people that do the work, that do the research, that do the analysis, that then gets passed on to the decision makers that we hope they will use to make the decision.
Yeah.
And that there was, from this time, this real unhappiness, to put it mildly, with those kinds of people who came to feel that in their work they were expected to validate decisions that had already been made. And this seems like this is the when you look at Iraq, you look at terrorism, that this is the main criticism that's been leveled at the Bush administration. That is, they were going with their gut first, and then they said to these kinds of people, now we want some data so that we can show that what we've already decided to do is the right thing to do.
Well, it's interesting because there's certainly lights of this. Prior to 9/11, the policy process, so-called, had been diminished already in the first months of the administration. It was clear that honest broker analysts throughout the government were producing whatever they produced, and it was not really being consumed by the president or the White House. They had made certain decisions. They wanted the data to be backfill, so to speak, to justify actions preordained. But what you have now after 9/11 is that ratcheting and widening dramatically, so that those who live on the planets of evidence in the government, CIA would certainly be one of them, were essentially told on high that what is dawning now after 9/11 is a new world of action, an evidence-free model, that we will act for good reason or bad reason or no reason articulated, and that, you know, the fact is your role has at this moment shrunk, and that's not just for the global war on terror, it's also for Afghanistan and Iraq especially. And that tension between the old planet of evidence and the new one of action is one that you see all through these 5 years, causing enormous concern, really, by folks who, frankly, have been in administrations before in many cases, who say if you act before you have essentially earned the right to act by virtue of the search and find, the due diligence, you're going to make mistakes, and mistakes at this level may have grievous consequences. Most presidents have been bound by those conventional hesitations, even rather tactically audacious presidents, Nixon one, let's just say. You know, they feel the burden of office, and they say, my God, I need to really search for the right answers here. I need to call in people who may disagree with me. I've got to, produce or have produced and thoroughly read and dig into very, very tough-minded analysis as to choices and consequences, or else I might make a mistake. And the consequences of that at this level are daunting. That's generally the way presidents have operated. This president generally, I would say, is unencumbered by those conventional hesitations. Some people say, look, that's in a way what the era demands. It demands action and not that kind of slow-footedness, if you will. That's what some of the neocons and some of the folks around the president have been saying. It's hard to know whether much of that is encouraged by what they have in a president, rather than maybe best-case scenarios.
Hmm. I think another thing that's significant about the book is it's laying out of who are the most important, the most influential individuals in the administration and how they relate to one another. And what comes across very clearly is, and I suppose this is no surprise to anybody who is paying attention, that perhaps one of the most influential individuals in this administration is the vice president.
Yeah.
How is it that, this I suppose is a question that really goes back beyond 9/11, how is it that in this administration it turned out that way, that the vice president has been such a powerful individual.
Well, it's interesting. I've been sort of an unofficial biographer of both the president and the vice president since certainly 2002, when I wrote a few stories for Esquire, and then The Price of Loyalty, a piece I wrote for the New York Times Magazine, and now this book. And I think in 1% Doctrine, I am able to render this very complex relationship between the vice president and the president with more clarity than I've been able to up to now, more clarity than I think others have. I think the best way to put it, David, is that the vice president is the most experienced vice president in modern times. The president, one of the least experienced presidents arriving in office, certainly in a very, very long time. And what you see from the very start is the vice president essentially constructing an architecture, a kind of platform in which George Bush can be George Bush and still be president in some way that will be viewed in the White House certainly as effective. And that means within this sort of framework, again, built by Cheney for the most part, the president can engage in his gut, embrace instinct, to be a man of action. But Cheney essentially is the builder of this White House in many cases. And in this book, what you see are the very odd and I think unprecedented consequences of that. We've never really had this before. We've had presidents who've been incapacitated and people have stepped in. You know, Woodrow Wilson is an example. But here you have key issues of policy. I mean, the central ones, in some cases, ending at the vice president's desk, and whole parts of the government constructed almost constitutionally to serve the president as their main consumer, they're ending up in service of the vice president. That's where their analysis or their hard work is essentially funneling to. This allows the president essentially to know much of what he knows through the vice president's particular presentation, if you will, and rendering, and allows the president to be deniable, in some cases, about his very own statements. As to, well, here's what I know based on what I was told, though I myself am not involved in these processes of search and find, of knowing the right answers, as other presidents have been. I mean, I have a case in the book where that people are saying, goodness gracious, where one of the most important foreign policy meetings at that point in this presidency in 2002, when the president meets with Crown Prince Abdul of Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince is there representing a roiling, angry Arab world at a time when we need them so desperately. After 9/11, they're enraged about the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. It's arguably the most important meeting the president has in foreign affairs. The Crown Prince comes to Crawford. What's clear is that the whole thing that happens that we know, where the president takes the Crown Prince in his pickup truck and they drive around the ranch, chit-chat this way and that, was something of a default, because in the actual meeting, the president didn't seem to know why the Saudis were there. They, of course, had sent ahead a few pages of very terse analysis as to what their interests are, what their recommendations are, what they hoped we would do. The president never read it. It ended at the vice president's desk. So the Saudis, after an hour of push and shove and presentation, said, well, I guess it's time for us to go. The president didn't seem to know why they were there. Now, Bush embraces a kind of improvisational energy. I think he has a gift for that, where he takes it in some new and unexpected direction. But when it comes to the lights of policy, of making these very complex decisions upon which so much rests, it's very difficult to do it with so little genuine analysis. And I think that's what we're finding in both domestic and certainly foreign affairs now, 6 years later.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is journalist Ron Suskind. He was for a number of years the senior national affairs reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He is the author of the book The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, published by Simon & Schuster, came out in June. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I wonder if I could ask you about somebody else that's almost conspicuous by their absence, not that he doesn't appear in the book, but the guy I'm thinking of is Colin Powell.
Yeah, sure.
And how it is that someone who is as capable, as smart, as articulate, as used to giving orders and having them followed as Colin Powell allowed himself, maybe he didn't allow himself, but it happened to be sidelined and to end up one of the least influential people in the cabinet when it came to foreign policy.
This president prizes certainty. He believes he's I said at one point in this New York Times Magazine piece I read that he's a confidence man, and Paul Krugman and others say you bet, as in bait and switch. I don't see it quite that way. I say a confidence man in that the president believes in almost the mystical power of his confidence, of his certainty. The problem is that Powell from the very start was the kind of person who had served other presidents, who is reality-based, fact-based, who understands the nuances of policy that in some ways undermined that preternatural world confidence of the president, because, you know, he kind of, how to put this, wasn't impressed, if you will. You know, he said, Mr. President, there are certain things you need to do, you need to think about, and I'm going to be the agent of that particular advice. So he was marginalized from the very beginning, of the administration, seen as a challenger to Cheney and to Rumsfeld, and in some ways to the president's carefully nourished certainty, so that the president could act, even though analysis sometimes was not part of that package. And you see Powell again and again frustrated. And ultimately, they decide there is a use for Powell. He has, you know, in some cases, the highest positive ratings of anyone in the administration by virtue of his earned credibility. And so what they do is they use him to make the presentation for war with, in certainly so many instances, false information. It's a tragic turn. I mean, if, you know, Dreiser were here, Shakespeare... You know, he would be writing the tragedy of Powell, and I think the book shows Powell's place. One thing I will say is that Powell is in the book in a couple of places, but he and others said to the president that Mr. President, you do not have a National Security Council process here, and without that, Powell, of course, had been NSC National Security Advisor to other presidents and chief of staff, you know, essentially head of the military as well, is that he said, without that, you simply won't know what you need to know as you make your choices. Rich Armitage, Powell's deputy, said that there was never an NSC process to break. It wasn't so much broken as Cohen felt. There was never one to start with. Bush said essentially he didn't want one. I think that means Cheney said he didn't want one. And Condi Rice comes off as a very complex character in the book, because many national security advisors would stand up at some point and say, Mr. President, just as Powell said to him, if you don't have an NSC process where you're actually getting a sense of what the principals or deputies in the NSC are saying, what they're fighting over and arguing about, and that distillate is not coming to your desk or it's not being seen as important, you are simply going to make errors for which the consequences are almost inestimable. And I won't preside over that, and I'm going to resign. Certainly, Condi Rice took a different path.
Yeah. We have some callers here, and I promise I will get to them in just a moment. I won't make them wait forever. Let me ask you about one more person that I think has also emerges as a very important person here, and in some sense is perhaps also a tragic figure, and that's George Tenet, the head of the CIA. As you explain in the book, after 9/11, there were a lot of people who thought he should have been fired. And the president didn't. And because the president didn't, Mr. Tenet was extremely grateful. Was his degree of gratitude, did that in some sense compromise his effectiveness and that of the CIA?
Well, you know what, Tenet and CIA in the years after 9/11 and certainly since, you know, 2003, 2004 and onward have been such a convenient, almost irresistibly convenient scapegoat for everything. You know, not just the war in Iraq, but, you know, right down to mortgage interest rates. I mean, everything under the sun, because they kind of can't defend themselves. So much of what they do is secret. And I think that one of the things I found in the reporting is that a charge that history will certainly level against this president is that by so utterly blaming the CIA totally for all fault in terms of pre-9/11 intelligence and the supposition of WMD in Iraq, both those things, that it made it absolutely a fait accompli that CIA in this partisan political environment would be gutted, would be eviscerated. And ultimately, what you learn in the book is that the relationships that Tenet and others, Team Tenet, the group of folks who had been running CIA for the last decade or so, the relationships they built up step by step, very slowly, with especially the Arab world, were actually some of our most important assets in this so-called war on terror. And washing them away, largely by virtue of deciding the political mandate was more important than almost anything else, which is a White House decision, really made us weaker in the most important area of protecting the country. And one of the reasons so many folks from the intelligence community cooperated with the project, at some risk to many of them, is because they felt that needs to be known so that we could go about the business of shoring up our assets in terms of making us actually safer rather than less safe.
He's apparently, the story is that he is working on a book himself, so yep. One of these days he may well come out and say, look, this is what happened as far as I'm concerned, or what I saw, and I don't know if that would yet be tempered by any feelings he might have, loyalty or gratitude towards Mr. Bush. Do you think that one of these days, though, he's going to come out and he may say something, he may
come out and say
what he really thinks, and that's going to be big?
During the time of my project, Tenet was on with a book contract, then off. He decided he couldn't do it, and then on again. And certainly, as I said publicly, he was cooperative with this project. He was not the primary source, as some reviewers have said. I said, you know, more than 100 people cooperated with the book throughout the government, both inside the government and folks who were formerly in top positions. George is now working on a book. He's got a partner, Bill Harlow, who is helping him write it. He was the former public affairs guy for CIA. It's hard to know what George's book is going to say. You know, George still, I think, wrestles with a variety of conflicts, which is one reason why he had a book contract and sort of said, I don't think I can do this. I'm not prepared to do what a publisher will want me to do. But then he got back on the horse. So, reports are it's going to be out sometime next year. And, of course, you know, in a town like Washington, there's some anticipation about that.
Our guest is Ron Suskind. From 1993 until 2000, he was the senior national affairs reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where he won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. His book, his new book, one that's been out now a couple of months, is The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, published by Simon & Schuster. We have several callers here. Again, callers will help us by trying to be brief. We'll get in as many as we can, starting with Charleston and line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks, Dave. A couple of things. What your guest has been articulating and what I understand about history and the decay of the old regime, which I'm beginning to think of Shakespearean plays and the monarchy in England and in France and Russia and places like that, where intrigue and the incompetency of those titular heads of the state and of the monarchy in those times, and in our own now with Mr. Bush, who seems, from what your guest is saying, having no thoughts of his own other than grandiose ideas. And then I guess my basic question is, from watching Channel 12 last night and Bill Moyer's piece and the Abramoff scandal and all that, and how the bourgeoisie were participants, but he didn't seem to imply that they were leading the pack. Well, if the titular head, you know, like you just said, of Dick Cheney, are actually running the show, and the bourgeoisie or the moneyed classes then play in behind that, that then ups the question, who is in charge? I mean, what is the state of society? I understand capitalism and all that, but where in as much is the power, where is the real power, and who is wielding that? How long can they do it? And what will be the results of these horrendous times? You know, the conspiracy theories and perhaps the facts of 9/11, if it was taken advantage of by people like George Bush, who was off on his cowboy run, you know, kicking everybody around, and suddenly we were the greatest hegemonic power on earth, you know, reminiscent of the old times, from pre-revolutionary bourgeois capitalism. Yeah. Maybe that's an awful lot, but I'll ring off and listen on radio.
It's Charleston, isn't it?
Yes, Charleston.
Charleston. Yeah. Well, Charleston, you're an erudite fellow, because clearly you've read history, and certainly, as Neil Ferguson and other writers, Gary Wills, have pointed out, we seem to be in a kind of vice of history here, certainly in terms of how great powers, even empires, erstwhile empire, maybe in our case, deal with times that change. In some cases, what you see again and again is that the thing and the features that bring an empire to its fullness get replaced, but that empire is often the last to see that. So much is invested in the status quo, a profitable status quo, a kind of aggrandizing status quo, that they end up being blind to the way the world's changing, maybe in a way that undermines so much that has been so successful. And I think that there is discussion of that now. There are many folks who say we need clarity and a kind of boldness of vision to come up with solutions, to figure out a way to challenge meaningfully the conflicts that we face, to be mindful of the lights of what has made America so successful, certainly over the 20th century. And, I think that those sorts of discussions, though they're messy and sometimes troubling, unsettling, ultimately are productive. Because, this ship of state can move in a lot of directions from this point forward. And the key is trying to, as a society, A, get the government we deserve. That's pretty much the way it always works. And have that ship move in the right direction so that 100 years from now, folks look back and say, they stopped, they thought clearly, and they moved in a way that ultimately was a kind of salvation for many of the values and virtues and earned rewards that America had at that point. And I think that's a big question for democracy at this point, as we come to our year of decision this year and another one in 2008, whether the democratic process of informed consent will in fact work.
Let's take another caller. This is someone in Mill Creek Valley, line one. Hello.
One comment and one question. A comment, first of all, regarding George Bush having the least experience of almost anybody in recent times. Well, he was governor of Texas. Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas for 2 years. George Bush was not governor of anything. Ronald Reagan was governor of California. Jimmy Carter was governor of Georgia. And dropping on back, I'm not sure of all this, Jack Kennedy had 2 years in the Senate. Roosevelt had been governor of New York. Eisenhower had been a general. What I'm saying is that nobody really has a great deal of experience, in my opinion, to handle such a job as the presidency. My question to you is, as an insider, as you apparently are, I was struck by one statement that you made regarding the visit to the Crawford Ranch and how George Bush did not seem to know why the visitor was there. Now, I don't know if that's correct or not. You're much closer than any of us. But what was your position that you knew that he did not seem to know? That's all.
That's a good question. How do you know something like that? Your opening comment
is a good one too. What's your name?
We don't ask people to give their names.
I think that my sense is certainly experience in foreign affairs. That's generally the way I craft that. The president had very little experience in foreign affairs. In fact, there are other presidents who have who have had a little experience in foreign affairs. I know a lot about other presidents at the point at which they arrive in office. And you know, I think George Bush himself would say that he had thought very, very little about the world and about foreign affairs. He said, you know, he didn't really travel very much. You know, Ronald Reagan, at the point at which he arrives in office, for instance, you know, he could go for weeks at a time head-to-head with the leading analysts of the Soviet Union. He really, and I think his letters in the recently published letters of Reagan show that. He had quite a bit more mastery than I think he was probably given credit for at the time. Certainly Kennedy as well. You know, when Bill Clinton arrives in office, you know, he is widely traveled. He has been engaged on foreign issues, met with foreign leaders for years because his inclinations and his both experience and study had led him in those directions. You know, I think what's interesting here is that this president doesn't seem to be inclined toward some of the natural inquisitiveness that generally presidents have been, embracing at a time where they need to know an awful lot, need to know it quickly. And you have moments thereby, like that one in Crawford that I mentioned. You know, several of the participants in the meeting from on high who were familiar with the situation because they were there, actually checked afterward to get a sense of what the devil went on just now. And that's how that disclosure was pulled together from several sources who checked later as to why the president didn't seem to know why the Saudis were there. And they found out that essentially the Saudi briefing materials never got to the president. He never read them. They ended at the vice president's desk. That's the way it is with most of the disclosures. I think virtually all of them in the book, they all come from multiple sources, and they were checked in many cases with current administration officials. And that's why they're there in this particular draft of history.
Yeah. Again, I hope the caller will forgive me. I have other callers. I want to go next to someone else in Charleston, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling because, I don't know, this the whole topic of post 9/11 and the U.S. relationship with the world really intrigues me. And I'm really concerned about the way, like, the path that the war on terror took just before and then going into Iraq, leading into Iraq. And I really, truly feel that, this scene in Iraq and that the war on terror since Iraq has been built on a foundation of lies and coercion. And, you know, if I believe that as an American, and I think there's a lot of others who do, I wonder, you know, what people who are getting attacked, how they feel about it, you know, and I wonder, if that belief is a little bit more widespread than just my apartment, you know, what does that mean for the U.S.? Like, what does that mean for us in Iraq, and what does that mean for us in the war on terror?
Well, you know, we clearly have lost moral authority. And there are lots of folks in Washington elsewhere saying, how can we restore that? I think one thing I can say, I think your framing of much of this is pretty sound. I say in the book, and I can say with great clarity, that we were probably winning. I think you could say we were winning the so-called war on terror through 2002 into early 2003. What you see here from intelligence reports is really quite fascinating, is that if the goal of any foreign policy is to unite your allies and divide your enemies, we actually had done both things. You know, on September 12th, remember, we had every country virtually in the world saying, what can I do to help? Even countries that were naturally aligned against us, many in the Arab world. There were candlelight vigils in Tehran. I think that's an important marker here. And here we have the odd circumstance of the world's most powerful nation, us, is receiving sympathy and offers of unlimited support from everyone. There was no one in the Arab world, I think, of consequence who felt we were not justified in invading Afghanistan and fleshing out al-Qaeda, the Taliban regime, and ultimately there we had that kind of experiment in nation building and building a democracy in the Arab world that, you know, is viewed by the neocons as a prized opportunity. As well, we were building through the improvisational urgency of the much of the government, certainly at CIA, Treasury, elsewhere, FBI, we were building in that first year and a half the kind of construct with a lot of mishaps, no doubt about it, of signal intelligence and, more importantly, human intelligence. I think the signal intelligence, the electronic stuff, is overrated. The key to winning these sorts of battles, human intelligence, individuals in the know who somehow managed to turn evidence to us. We had that, and I have those victories in 1% Doctrine. It's quite heartening for some people as they read it. You know, the guy who turned in Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, human intelligence, a jihadist who said, that's not my Islam, and I'm meeting KSM, the planner of 9/11, tonight. He turned him in. He got his $25 million reward. He lives somewhere in America with his family, his cousins, you know, everybody safe and secure forever, unknown where they are. We had a source inside of al-Qaeda. I mentioned him in the book. I call him Ali. He was a senior source, again, who felt, this is fascinating, that maybe the attack on 9/11 was a mistake, that bin Laden's estimation that the U.S. Army would arrive in Afghanistan and be caught in a quagmire actually didn't occur. We were, I think, shrewd as to how we fought that battle, even though we were a bit late to the party. We ended up dispersing al-Qaeda. We overthrew the Taliban regime. Folks inside of the organization were here and hither and yon. And when a moment like that occurs, dissension builds. Maybe some things we should have done differently. That's what got us a human source. That person could not be more valuable. That's what we had at that point. You know, think about the London bombing that was foiled. Why was that? It's because a jihadist, a Muslim fundamentalist in the United Kingdom, after the London bombings in 2005, said, this is not my Islam. This cannot be justified. He overheard something pertinent from the actual actors who were planning this attack, and he contacted British authorities. We used to get that kind of assistance before Iraq, before that experiment went south, before the United States started to be viewed as an angry and reckless and not particularly responsible power that will do all sorts of things, not just in terms of what it does with its army, but at places like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Our loss of moral authority, the chances at this point of a jihadist, of a Muslim fundamentalist, close enough to the terrorists or potential terrorists to hear something pertinent, that person coming to the U.S. or intermediaries, slim to none at this point, and that makes us blind at a time where we need sight. It makes us less safe. Make no mistake, our human intelligence assets have withered since the Iraq invasion. You can almost mark it by the month passing. Month to month, year to year, and right now we are largely blind as to the kind of things we need to know before they occur. It's quite harrowing.
You know, we're going now into about our last 10 minutes, and I hesitate to get into Iraq because that's almost another subject, but maybe you can talk at least here for a minute, because one of the things that I think a lot of people are still struggling with is why the administration decided to go into Iraq in the first place. And it wasn't helped, understanding wasn't helped by the fact that it seemed that in the run-up to the war, we were given several different reasons. And now I suppose the one that they've settled on, the only one that they've really got is, well, they say this is an important front on the war on terror. Why did the administration decide to invade Iraq?
Well, you know, I in my other book, The Price of Loyalty, set down a marker, an important disclosure, that it was about Iraq from the very first National Security Council meeting in January of 2001. The president basically said, Iraq's going to be our focus, Condi Rice. They even rolled out, you know, a picture of a potential weapons factory in Iraq to justify an attack. It was about regime change. It was about owning that country from the very first. What's interesting is that the real rationale, if I can succinctly put it here in terms of what really drove them, was that, here are things they decided from the beginning. WMDs are going to spread no matter what we do. It's futile to try to stop them. They're carried on civil technology, widely available. That means rogue states like Iran or North Korea or potentially Iraq are going to get their hands on these weapons, and by virtue of that, deny the United States primacy that we've had in many regions of the world. We don't have any ready way to combat this. So we will make an example of Saddam Hussein to engage in what the neocons actually agree is kind of a global experiment in behaviorism. Now, of course, any psychologists out there know when you do an experiment like that with four people, often there are too many variables. We're conducting one with much of the planet. The idea was, we will make an example of Saddam Hussein, a demonstration model, as they said in the administration, to show the world the new rules of the game of U.S. unilateralism, of U.S. power, so that others who are considering challenging the United States with similar temerity as Hussein will know what to expect, and that will keep them, essentially, from going down that path. The view was Saddam would be an easy mark. Thereby, we will go forward. We'll make an example of him. Now, obviously, demonstration models are not the province simply the United States. They're not patentable, and anyone can jump into one of those. And much of the Arab world has, of course, turned Iraq into a demonstration model of U.S. recklessness, of U.S. confusion, and of the limits of U.S. power. And for bin Laden, who for years talked about the U.S. desire to essentially own and invade countries in the Arab world, he couldn't have asked for a better recruitment poster. And in fact, Iraq has created, as all the intelligence reports show, including the new NIE just out, a bonanza in jihadist recruitment around the planet. The numbers have multiplied and metastasized.
Yeah.
And that's what we're facing because of Iraq. This global experiment in behaviorism backfired. And at this point, the question is, what do we do? What do we do in an era in which essentially angry partisanship in the United States is ensnaring many folks on both sides in rhetoric that so narrows the field of play and the field of options? It's not a hopeful scenario.
Ron Suskind is our guest. He's former reporter for The Wall Street Journal, author of a relatively new book, The 1% Doctrines, published by Simon & Schuster. We have some callers. We'll try to get him in. Going next to someone in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Thank you. Given the revelations of Kofor Black and others, what do you think about the possibility, the reason for Tenet not being fired after 9/11 was because he could have gone to the public and said, hey, I tried to warn the president, but, you know, we were ignored. Condoleezza Rice brushed us off, the vice president, you know, brushed us off, and we just, you know, they just didn't pay attention. We tried to warn them.
Yep, you know, I say that in my book. You know, I have the meeting in August where CIA briefers are with the president. It's not just that memo we know about on August 6th. It's that briefers invaded a vacation space in Crawford to sound alerts face-to-face, and the president said at one point after one such briefing that all the arrows are pointing in red, that we know something's coming, we just don't know when, but my goodness, he said, all right, you've covered your ass now, dismissively. Yes, certainly George Tenet was armed with potentially dangerous disclosures, and I think that was part of the way the president's relationship, that of the two Georges, evolved and evolved all the way through in a sort of odd codependency right to the end of Tenet's tenure.
Well, if that's the case, then is it too outlandish to postulate that they welcomed this attack as a way, maybe they wouldn't have if they realized how horrendous it was going to be, but that they welcomed it as their excuse for invading Iraq?
I don't go down that path, though I've heard others. You know, I think there's no doubt that the attack was harrowing for those in leadership, as it was for everyone in the United States. I think, though, that what is clear is that there was preparations made in terms of Iraq, in terms of the unitary executive idea of expanding presidential power. That's something they'd been working on from the very start. And Iraq, rather, 9/11 did provide these this strange array of opportunities where preparation would then arrive on the landscape of action.
I want to try to get. I want to thank the caller again and try to get one more. Champaign County. Yep. This is line one.
Thank you.
Hello.
On this line, though, not the 9/11, but just the idea that in your earlier book talking about Iraq being on the agenda from the first meeting.
Yep.
I think that there are a lot of other indications. The PNAC, so making this 1% solution such a dramatic change and saying everything changed after 9/11, these people had this agenda. Who knows why it was enabled, how it was enabled with 9/11, but, you know, Cheney was already de-anonymizing NSA things before 9/11. The Bloomberg on the Friday before July 4th, and I haven't heard much comment on it, said that the deal with AT&T, then SBC, for looking over records and supposedly in an anonymous way, was cut 7 months before 9/11. So a lot of this was in train. Emphasizing that there was this one day that 1% was enough, I don't believe it. I think the agenda, as you say, they want to make the reality. They don't need the evidence.
Right, so. Right. I think you're right. It's just it's a matter of how you shade it. There's no doubt that much of what we see now started well before 9/11, and that 9/11 provided the landscape in which it would come to the fore. In terms of Cheney's 1% doctrine. What it ends up doing, though, is it ends up being essentially the core, officially, of the U.S. playbook, even though there was plenty that had been developed prior to that in terms of the diminution, the shrinking of the place of evidence and analysis in the policy debate and making decisions. So that in a way, the 1% doctrine is part of a progression. But it clearly was a bit of a thunderbolt inside of the administration where people said, well, now I've got it. We have a doctrine. This is the rule that will guide us and that we will operate largely and officially in an evidence-free realm. And that is sanctioned and essentially our marching orders. And that affects virtually everything that goes forward as a kind of bottom line, which is what Dick Cheney's about. He's the bottom line man. And he, guiding so many of these proceedings, guided them in the way he saw fit.
We're at the point here we're going to have to stop. Just real quick here, maybe we have about a minute. The administration now has continued to try to make the point that September, we shouldn't think that September 11th was an isolated event, that Al-Qaeda, perhaps other kinds of groups, are going to continue to try to do things like this. And they have also made, the president, I think, has made the point that attempts have been made and have been blocked. Within the administration, do they indeed think that it's only a matter of time that there will be another event like this, maybe even bigger, and that it's going to happen? It's just, you know, do they go to sleep every night thinking tomorrow could be the day?
Yeah, you know, something that's going to really spin you around is that as long as U.S. policy moves forward on such a disastrous track, that actually may be what's keeping us safe from another attack. Al-Qaeda does what it does for reasons, strategic reasons. Actually, they're quite strategic. And right now, there's nothing they need to do. We're doing it to ourselves. If that ceases, it might provide essentially the impetus for them to strike. And mostly those folks at the very bleeding edge of this say Al-Qaeda has the capability, they have the will, they will strike at a time and place of their choosing. The U.S. is largely indefensible. And the question is when they will decide to attack. They are their acolytes. They are their imitators or sort of franchisees. And I think that's the fact of the world we're living in right now. You know, it's important for Americans to take ownership of this, I think, and that's what the book attempts to do, for better or for worse, so that we can do what Americans do, which is get engaged in the times in which we live.
Well, have the changes that we have made in law enforcement and intelligence gathering, all that kind of stuff that's happened since 9/11, have they in fact been helpful?
They've been helpful, but, you know, ultimately it's a matter of of response, of adaptability. You know, we adapt, they adapt. You know, we take one step, they take the next step. We try to chase them. And the fact is our enemy, you know, has evolved in ways that make them particularly difficult for us to find and find before the operational moment. That is the fact of it. You know, it's not like it was back then in those first 2 years after 9/11 where we had some successes, where, you know, the communications and money, you know, the flow of resources was in a hierarchical structure where you could basically trace it up toward the top, if not to the top. Now you've got this model, which is, look, it's a little bit like when mainframes got replaced by, you know, connected forests of CD, of PCs. It's very, very difficult right now to know where the enemy lies, where the battlefront is, this largely invisible battlefield, and where the next attack is coming from. And I'll tell you, this is an era, by virtue of the miracle of the information age, where so much that is so extraordinary, empowering around the world, that the dark cousin at the table is that individuals or small groups can now carry the destructive power once reserved for nations. That's a huge change in the history of mankind. And right now, we have not figured out a way, as the world's most powerful nation, to respond. We need to come up with a strategy. We need to do it quickly. And we need to have a coherent foreign policy where the left hand is not undermining what the right hand is doing. So that essentially, years from now, we said we did the right thing at the right time.
Our guest this morning, Ron Susskind. If you'd like to read his book, it's The 1% Doctrine. It's published by Simon & Schuster. He's former reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He was senior national affairs reporter at the Journal from 1993 until 2000, where he won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. Mr. Susskind, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, David. Thank you.